From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
In New York, a sex scandal and sanctions against Iran. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. New York's Democratic Governor Eliot Spitzer has 48 hours to resign, or Republicans in Albany are threatening impeachment. Next in line, Lieutenant Governor David Patterson, a Democrat from Harlem who's legally blind. Will sexual misconduct end a career that might have led to the White House? Also on To the Point, new UN sanctions against Iran's nuclear enrichment program. Will they help to isolate a major regional power? Is Iran more interested in what's happening next door in Iraq? Are the U.S. and Iran engaged in what amounts to a Cold War in the Middle East? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Since yesterday's brief public apology, New York Governor Eliot Spitzer has been holed up in his Fifth Avenue apartment. On To the Point, will he resign or face impeachment? What about criminal charges? In the second half of our program, will UN sanctions persuade Iran to slow down its nuclear program? Is Iran more interested in Iraq? First, this news update. Republican leaders in Albany are threatening impeachment if Democratic Governor Eliot Spitzer doesn't resign in 48 hours. Here's the Assembly Minority Leader, James Tedisco.
We have asked that the governor resign as soon as possible, and we've said that within 24 to 48 hours, if he does not resign and remove this distraction so Lieutenant Governor Patterson can take that position to move us forward, that we would put forth a resolution for articles of impeachment.
Tedisco says he's already promised Republican support if Democratic Lieutenant Governor David Patterson assumes the governorship. Jay Jochnowitz is state editor for the Albany Times-Union, and Jay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What are the Democrats saying?
Well, we were hearing this morning that some of the Democrats are already starting to carry around copies of the law and the Constitution, and they are also talking about impeachment. It's an uncomfortable situation for everyone, I wouldn't say for everyone, but for many people, and I don't think the Democrats want to be left behind on this.
There have been reports that the governor's staff has talked to Lieutenant Governor Patterson's staff about a transition. Have you been able to confirm that?
Well, you know, we're still looking into that, but interestingly enough, just in the last minute while your show was starting, we just blogged something from one of our reporters who had just done a profile of Lloyd Constantine, and Lloyd Constantine is a top aide to the governor. He did mark the courtesy of giving him a heads up with a response that he said that reports of the governor's resignation is imminent are not true. Now, what that means, he's not elaborating. I mean, it could be hours from now, it could be days from now, it could be that this governor is digging in.
Digging in or negotiating for some kind of plea bargain is one of the other items of speculation, but I don't suppose any of us at this point has any way to know.
That is the other key thing that we've heard, that what the governor's looking to do is negotiate with the prosecutors on how he can get out of this as gracefully as possible with as little damage to his I don't know if his career is salvageable, but his law license, for one thing, as well as his freedom. I don't know that anything that we've heard so far is serious enough to be talking prison time, but we don't know.
We'll talk more about that a little bit later on our program. In the meantime, what can you tell us about Lieutenant Governor Patterson?
Well, you know, you're talking about a well-liked guy who did well over in the Senate, gained quite a measure of respect as a minority leader, which isn't always easy to do. You're usually ignored as a minority leader, and actually, I think if Governor Spitzer has a legacy here, it's that two minority leaders in a row have kind of risen higher than or gotten higher profiles than people have in the past. Patterson becoming lieutenant governor, he made a lot of friends along the way, doesn't seem to have made any enemies, and by all accounts is an astute politician, if he does have to come into office, he seems like he's ready to do it.
There was some talk about him as a possible successor to Hillary Clinton, or at least a candidate to be successor to Hillary Clinton in the event that she were elected president.
Mm-hmm. There was talk that he had his eye on that seat, and he was probably probably one of the most, you know, if there were top three or four or five choices, he probably was one of them if he wanted it. And if he did, it would have. I could see him in that position, that he would want to be in that position. But I think that I don't think he hitched his ride on Spitzer Starr for nothing. And if he does want to. I don't think being governor is something he would be reluctant to do if he had to do it.
He's a very interesting character in a number of ways. He is legally blind, has been apparently since he was very young. He would be the first disabled person to be governor of New York since Franklin Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And he's also African-American, comes from Harlem.
Yep. And he would be the first black governor of New York. Yeah, pretty extraordinary. You know, it's if it wasn't for the fact that we were in the middle of, a virtually, I wouldn't say unprecedented crisis, but pretty close to it in New York, this would be a rather extraordinary story in itself.
Again, we're talking with Jay Jochnowitz, who is state editor for the Albany Times-Union. Understand there are a few news trucks up there circling around the state capitol.
Actually, one of my reporters just called up. I've been, as an editor, unfortunately, glued to my desk just about, or desk or phone. But one of my other reporters, Rick Carlin, called up to tell me that there are quite a few news trucks there. There's every development, every coming or going of a top official is suddenly gaining huge degrees of importance. So we heard that the acting state police superintendent was headed this way. What that means, you know, on a normal day, it wouldn't even, you know, nobody would bat an eyebrow. So I'm not so sure there's really any news to that.
Is that who guards the governor?
Not personally, no.
Okay.
State police are
That's what I meant.
Do.
Yeah.
But you know, that's on a regular basis. He could have any number of reasons for being here.
Sure. Okay. Well, obviously, things very lively in Albany at the moment, even though the current governor, the incumbent, is still down in New York City. Jay Jochnowitz, thanks a lot for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Again, the state editor for the Albany Times Union. A bit later on, we'll be talking about Iran, UN sanctions, and a kind of cold war with the United States in a moment. More on Elliot Spitzer on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To The Point. As we've just heard, Elliot Spitzer's first term as governor of New York may be about to come to an end unless he's digging in or conducting a plea bargain. In any case, he has his defenders, as well as those who are very critical of him at the moment. Alan Dershowitz, renowned constitutional scholar at Harvard Law, where Spitzer served as his research assistant, said this today.
This is private sexual misconduct, and we know from history, from Jefferson, from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, from Bill Clinton, from John Kennedy, from Lyndon Johnson, that people can govern well during the day while acting as children and adolescents in the evening. This is just so overblown.
Alan Dershowitz, once again, a friend of Elliot Spitzer and a well-known legal scholar. Paul Callan is a former New York City prosecutor. He's a criminal defense attorney as well. And Mr. Callan, welcome to you.
Nice to be here.
Private sexual misconduct is one thing. What do we know that might lead to either state or federal charges against Governor Spitzer?
Well, I think the difference here, Warren, between this being private sexual conduct and criminal conduct is that, of course, the governor was paying prostitutes for sex. These prostitution rings are frequently linked to organized crime entities. We know from published reports that the governor was being investigated for putting his money in shell corporations to try to hide the money as he used it to pay for illegal activity. So there's something a lot more here than private sexual activity. Governor Spitzer is the chief law enforcement official of the entire state of New York, and he's got to be held to a standard of where he has to obey the law.
And he served as attorney general of the state for two terms.
Well, he not only served as attorney general of the state for two terms, but he was a law enforcement officer who really placed his own moral rectitude on a pedestal. And he was the lawman's lawman, the DA's DA. And for him now, for people to find out that he himself was committing a crime, I think there's a hypocrisy issue here that just is going to take him down in a way that maybe it wouldn't take down a lot of other politicians.
Might take him down as a politician. Hypocrisy, though, isn't a crime. Paying for sex is, although under federal law particularly, the Johns, as they're called, aren't often prosecuted, are they?
Well, no, they're virtually never prosecuted under federal law, but bear in mind that the governor here has committed a violation of what is known as the Mann Act. He, and this is clear from the intercepted telephone communications, he paid to have these women travel across state lines to Washington, D.C. to engage in acts of prostitution. Now, that is a Mann Act violation. It's punishable by 5 years in prison, and it's a violation of federal law.
Mann Act goes back, I think, to 1910. It's an old law and one of the oldest in the federal criminal statutes. You used the plural. You said women. Was there more than one woman involved?
Well, there are reports now. Newsday is reporting today that there might have been as many as seven other occasions where the governor used this particular service. I don't know that on those seven other occasions they crossed state lines, although there are reports of encounters in Florida and some other states. So I think when this is said and done, you're going to find multiple occasions where he paid to have women transported across state lines. There's no question, if prosecutors want to move on him with a Mann Act violation, they will nail him for this. And, you know, it has an interesting historical background, the Mann Act. It was used to prosecute Charlie Chaplin, Frank Lloyd Wright, Charles Manson. So you have quite a gallery of people. The government's very selective about when it uses it, but they frequently use it to bring down celebrities.
If the governor agrees to resign, would that be enough, do you think, to get prosecutors at either the federal or state law level to pull away and not prosecute him?
I suspect that it will be enough to get them to walk away from the case. You know, there's a long history in the United States of this sort of deal being done with politicians. We've seen governors, senators, mayors of major cities trade their resignation from office for immunity on the criminal side. So it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, what prosecutors look at ultimately is, does the punishment fit the crime? This is essentially the destruction of Elliot Spitzer's personal and professional life. He'll be forced to give up the highest office in the state. His career as a lawyer is probably destroyed. He can be disbarred for these activities. So I suspect that that may be enough of a trade for prosecutors to agree to walk away from the criminal charges.
Paul Callan, former New York prosecutor, a criminal defense attorney. Brooke Masters is senior business reporter at the Financial Times in London, author of Spoiling for a Fight, The Rise of Elliot Spitzer. Brooke Masters, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
The big question, I think, on everyone's mind is why on earth or how could this happen to this particular guy under these circumstances? In your lengthy research of his life and career, did you find him to be a reckless person?
He is a guy who has been accused of not thinking the rules apply to him. You know, his very first campaign for attorney general, he skirted, if not broke, the campaign finance laws by using loans from his dad, and really was not at all repentant when caught doing it. He basically said, I had to do it in order to win. So there is some history that the rules don't necessarily apply to Elliot Spitzer. I did not, in my research, and most of his aides that I talked to had no idea that he had any sort of sexual issues. He's not a guy who comes across as, you know, being either extremely repressed or extremely sexual. So that part's very odd and sort of unexpected. But he definitely was a guy who pushed boundaries. He used laws in ways they were not written to be used in order to do what he thought was right.
Go ahead.
Oh, and I would say, and in general, he was really popular for it. People like crusaders when they're going after the right targets. But people who think that laws can be pushed around may also do it for their own personal gain or pleasure, and that apparently, if the allegations are true, is what happened here.
Just got himself in trouble recently for having his staff get the New York State Police to try to discredit the Senate Majority Leader, Republican Joseph Bruno. How was he doing how popular was he amongst the people he had to deal with, both as Attorney General and during his brief year as governor?
Well, I think as Attorney General, he was very popular among his constituents and among small investors who really felt he was the guy sticking up for them against big, powerful corporations that were prospering at a time when Americans were losing a lot of money in their personal retirement accounts and their college accounts. In terms of his targets, there are very few of them who have nice things to say about him. Although it is interesting that a number of the people who worked at the big Wall Street banks he went after will say privately that, look, you know, they thought he overdid it, that his rhetoric was overheated, that he demonized them, but in fact he did expose problems that needed to be exposed. And they wish someone else had done it in a more measured manner, but that he did bring some good to Wall Street. I mean, disclosures are much better written now. You know, as much as the subprime crisis is a disaster right now and is bringing the mortgages are causing all kinds of trouble, but in fact there will probably be fewer lawsuits because there were better disclosures, and some of that is because of Eliot Spitzer.
Brooke Masters, again, the author of Spoiling for a Fight, The Rise of Eliot Spitzer. We're talking about what appears to be the fall of Eliot Spitzer. Monica Langley is Deputy Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. She's written a piece today about Wall Street cheering as its nemesis plunges into crisis. And Monica Langley, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, that's not all your story is about, and I think it's important to point that out. He certainly does have supporters as well as detractors, but there are people on Wall Street that really are cheering.
They are. I mean, yesterday when the news started coming across the wires, the trading floors in most of the big securities firms were, they just stopped. It wasn't like the market was stopped, but they stopped because this is a man who has basically terrorized them for the last few years. And I agree with Brooke that he was considered like the people's lawyer, and the small investors loved him. But Wall Street overall felt that he came on too strong, too hard. And even though he was right in much of what he did, they did not like his bullying style, becoming a sheriff on Wall Street.
How did he get that name, bullying or sheriff on Wall Street? What do you mean by a bullying style?
Well, you know, he didn't mind, you know, threatening CEOs that he, I mean, when he took on Wall Street, it was Sandy Weill at Citigroup. Later it was Hank Greenberg at AIG, the big insurance giant. And he basically was pretty clear, you resign or you change your practices or I'm coming after you. He relished that kind of fight. So they did not appreciate his style. On the other hand, I have to say there are people who are involved in corporate governance, for example, Nell Minow, I quoted in my story today, who said she's really sorry that his career is coming to an end because he made some lasting changes to clean up Wall Street and make it more transparent for investors.
And Nell Minow, we've talked to her several times on our program, as somebody who represents the small investors against what she believes are the abuses of the big firms.
And if you notice now, anybody who's a shareholder and gets an annual report from a publicly traded company, you will see that almost all companies now have corporate governance committees. This was really started by Eliot Spitzer. He extracted that out of companies before he would settle with them, that they had to have the board of directors to be accountable for what they were paying the CEOs, what cozy deals they were doing, and that kind of thing. So he will make a lasting effect, even if his career is over.
Again, Monica Langley is Deputy Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. Let me go back to Paul Callan, our former New York City prosecutor, who's now a criminal defense attorney. You were talking about the case against Spitzer. Would prosecutors, because of his record, presuming for the moment that he really did accomplish good things on Wall Street, perhaps make the governance of investment firms more open and transparent and consequently better than it has been, would that sort of work in his favor as they're deciding whether or not to smack him with an indictment?
Oh, no, I don't think that'll factor in at all. You know, prosecutors are much tougher on their own. There's nobody harder than a prosecutor who sees a fellow law enforcement person violating the law. So, you know something, he gets no points for being a tough guy. And as a matter of fact, it's just going to work the other way. It'll work against him.
Was he well regarded by other prosecutors while he was attorney general?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I think people had they respected him because he was innovative and creative in the way he used the criminal law to try to bring what he perceived as reforms on Wall Street. But there was a certain feeling among other prosecutors that he liked to showboat in the press and that his prosecutions were about Eliot Spitzer getting headlines. And I think that may have created some resentment among other prosecutors.
Brooke Masters, back to you, author of Spoiling for a Fight, The Rise of Eliot Spitzer. What about this? Did he, in fact, try a lot of cases in the press?
Well, he certainly was the master of the calculated leak. I mean, his office was fantastic at getting the salacious details out at the right moment where it would have the most impact. Many of my colleagues were recipients of very timely leaks. Now, it should be noted he's not the only one who does that. Certainly the Justice Department and the SEC is well known to leak as well, but he was extremely good at it. And he also was a plain speaker who liked to hear himself talk and would sometimes go on TV and say things that other prosecutors thought was over the line. The most famous example is when he said that what happened at American International Group, which is a big insurance company, looks criminal to him before he had filed any charges of any kind against anyone. And everybody went nuts. That was completely inappropriate. What's interesting about that is a guy from AIG got convicted last week on the basic facts that Spitzer was talking about, as well as three people who participated from another company. Mm. So it is interesting that in the end, some of his rhetoric was backed up with facts, but he tended to get ahead of his court documents, which is against the rules, particularly in federal court, and definitely offended a lot of other people in the law enforcement community.
He apparently was found out by virtue of a routine financial investigation because large amounts of money had been moved around. The banks notified the IRS. The IRS notified the FBI and so on. And of course, he was also caught because of telephone taps. Wouldn't he, as a prosecutor, have been in a position to understand that the kind of behavior he was engaged in would call attention to him, especially when he was governor of the state?
Absolutely. The behavior is reckless. I mean, it's reckless by anybody who lives in the modern world and reads the newspaper. It's extraordinarily reckless for a man who made his career wiretapping mobsters and, you know, reading emails of bankers. I can't explain it. You got to wonder what was going through his head. And this is pure psychobabble, but maybe the pressure was getting to him. I mean, he's governor of a state, his popularity is plummeting because he's feuding with everybody. He can't figure out how to get out of his problems. I don't know, but you got to wonder, like, why would you do something that on the surface appears so inherently stupid?
On the other hand, Monica Langley, back to you with the Wall Street Journal. In Washington, the reforms that he did achieve, the accomplishments that are attributed to him on Wall Street and in the governance of corporations, I take it, are expected to last.
They are. I mean, he also has not only put in reforms within corporate America, but also I think the prosecutors and state attorneys general across the U.S. now see that there are ways that they can represent investors that they had not really done before. One interesting side note is on Saturday night, Mr. Spitzer was down here in Washington, D.C. for the annual Gridiron Dinner where President Bush spoke. And I was there and I chatted with him. And he seemed like a man who did not have a care in the world.
All right. Monica Langley with The Wall Street Journal. Brooke Masters, her book, Spoiling for a Fight, The Rise of Elliot Spitzer, and Paul Callan, a former New York City prosecutor. Many thanks to all of you. We're going to come back, talk about the situation in Iran with new UN sanctions on To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. Last week's UN Security Council vote to sanction Iran for nuclear development was just one vote short of unanimous. But the sanctions themselves were much weaker than the Bush administration had wanted to demonstrate that Iran is isolating itself from the international community. David Albright is president of the Institute for Science and International Security. He's written numerous assessments of secret nuclear weapons programs throughout the world. And Mr. Albright, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, glad to be here.
Are these sanctions strong enough to make much difference to Iran?
Well, the sanctions aren't envisioned to be crippling by any means. The financial sanctions that are part of this UN Security Council resolution and also part of actions taken by the United States unilaterally and then by some of its allies in Europe are meant to hurt more, hurt the government more, make it harder to do trade. But in the end, the sanctions aren't intended to break the will of Iran. The intention is to show Iran that there's opposition to their continuing to enrich uranium, refusing to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency, and try to change the dynamic within Iran to be more supportive of fruitful negotiations.
How much was the whole effort weakened by the national intelligence estimate that said that Iran had stopped its nuclear program a couple of years ago?
It was hurt a great deal. I mean, the UN Security Council resolution was going to be much stronger. The European Union would have supported much stronger sanctions in the resolution, particularly financial sanctions. And once the national intelligence estimate came out, it just took the wind out of the sails of that entire effort. And although it's interesting, the Europeans were quite clear that the national intelligence estimate really, its headline conclusion, you know, Iran's nuclear weaponization program stopped in late 2003, that was not a big surprise to them. And it had nothing to do with why they worried that Iran could build nuclear weapons in the future and worried about Iran's ongoing uranium enrichment program and wanted to see that program suspended until confidence could be reestablished that Iran wasn't going to build nuclear weapons in the future.
Is there any way, short of an invasion of some kind, to prevent Iran from learning how to enrich uranium to weapons-grade quality if it wants to do that?
Well, the issue isn't so much learning how to do it. The issue is really putting in place a capability that can do it. I mean, certainly if it takes them longer to do it, in the sense they take longer to learn it, that's better for the diplomatic approach, the sanctions approach. But in the end, if Iran is determined to get nuclear weapons, then it's not even clear war could stop them. I mean, short of a full-scale invasion and occupation. I mean, many scenarios for military strikes are going to leave the nation of Iran intact and able to retaliate. So I think the issue really is how do you keep the pressure on Iran, keep offering incentives. I mean, one of the failures of the Bush administration is it hasn't offered engagement or negotiations in any meaningful way. And until the NIE came out, it was in the background was, you know, we're going to whack you. We're going to destroy your regime. We're going to strike you militarily. And that only worsened the situation, made the Iranians even more nationalistic. And so the hope is with a new administration, a critical feature of a new Iran policy will be let's sit down and talk and try to negotiate this out. And we do want a suspension in the enrichment program, but it's certainly not forever necessarily, and we'll promise not to attack you if you agree to these kinds of conditions.
The problem against that, or the argument against that, as I understand it, is that in the past Iran has not kept promises of that sort and that there would be no reason to believe they would again.
Well, I don't know. Iran's never been fully tested on this. I mean, if you look at the deal that was struck between Iran and the Europeans in the fall of 2003, Iran agreed to suspend its enrichment program, and it did that. It agreed to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to step up the level of inspections. It agreed to do that. What it said to the Europeans in the end is, look, your incentives aren't enough to convince us to stop, and you want us to stop for 10 years. In the background was the United States that started initially throwing stones at the deal, all kinds of military threats, some embodied by a comment that I heard out of the State Department was that this is in the fall of 2002 they were saying when we get to Baghdad, we're turning right, implying that, you know, as soon as we knock off the Iraqi regime, and that'll be a cakewalk, we're going to take on the Iranian regime. And so if you're from an Iranian point of view, having the United States sit there and say, look, no matter what you do, we're going to knock you off, that's not an incentive to give up your nuclear weapons capability. And so it was almost inevitable that the discussion between the Europeans and the Iranians would collapse unless the United States weighed in and said, look, you know, as they did in North Korea, say, you know, we're not going to attack you. We're not going to try to destroy your regime. But we do want this, this, and that. And if you don't agree to it, we're willing to sanction you, isolate you, but we're not going to start the invasion.
David Albright, again, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, experienced in the area of assessing secret nuclear weapons programs around the world. Cilic Harrison is director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy. He's covered Iran during his long time with the Washington Post, and he's recently been in that country. And Cilic Harrison, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
What did you find when you got there, and do you think that the Iranians are concerned about these sanctions?
Well, when I was in Tehran just before Ahmadinejad went on his very interesting visit to Baghdad a week ago, nobody was talking about the nuclear issue. They're not concerned about UN sanctions. What they're concerned about is that the feeling that the United States is digging in for a long occupation of Iraq, making it a kind of U.S. Protectorate on the borders of Iran, and therefore making the question of the no-attack commitment that David was talking about very, very important. The Iranians feel that they've been trying to help us to stabilize Iraq during the so-called surge by restraining Muqtada al-Sadr and the other Shiite militias in Iraq. And, you know, Muqtada al-Sadr suspended his operations for 6 months, just renewed it again for another 6 months. But what they think, what they say is, look, we've done that, and what are you doing? You're building up the Sunni militias, the so-called Sunni Awakening. The U.S. has armed 90,000 Sunnis, who are, of course, in the eyes of the al-Maliki government, which is a Shia government, a direct offset to them, a threat to them, a challenge to their ability to dominate the security scene. And the Shiite militias, the Badr militia of Hakim, the leading Shia leader, has only 15,000 people. Muqtada al-Sadr has 60,000, so that's 75,000 in the so-called Shia militias. Here we are building up the Sunni forces to the tune of 90,000 at $300 a month, each one, the so-called Sunni awakening. So what the Iranians are concerned about is that we're going to try to stay in Iraq with a kind of divide-and-rule strategy in which we keep a civil war going in order to make sure that they don't get increasing influence as a result of their close ties with the al-Maliki government.
What do they think about the American presidential campaign with candidates saying they want to get out of Iraq sooner rather than later on the Democratic side?
Well, it's interesting. The Iranians, I didn't find any of the different shades of opinion in Tehran talking about a quick U.S. withdrawal. They recognize that any withdrawal of U.S. combat forces has to be gradual. They won't talk about specific timetables, but I would say they're more sympathetic to the Barack Obama approach than anybody else's, certainly not Mr. McCain's, which is what they're worried about, a long-term U.S. presence, which would give the U.S. a capability for attacks on Iran because we're going to have very sophisticated bases there. So they want a withdrawal over maybe 18 months or something like that of combat forces. They don't want to see this new security agreement that is now being negotiated as we talk by Mr. Satterfield, I guess it is, from the State Department and others who are out in Baghdad talking to the al-Maliki government about an agreement to replace the UN mandate under which the U.S. forces have been in Iraq. Something's got to replace that.
It's going to run out.
It's going to run out at the end of the year. The administration has talked at one time about something which would sound like a very, to the Iranians, quite ominous, in which we'd have commitments to Iraq to defend them against their neighbors. But it's a great deal of confusion about exactly what we are trying to negotiate. But it's become, as you know, a political issue because Hillary Clinton has led the way, and I think Barack Obama also, they're working together to make sure that this any agreement agreed to goes before Congress. And the administration is saying that we can negotiate the future U.S. military relationship with Iraq without the U.S. congressional approval because the original authorization is sufficient. So Iran is looking at what the future American presence and role in Iraq is going to be. To what extent are we going to permit the electoral verdict of early 2005 in which a Shia-dominated government took power? To what extent are we going to let that government really hold sway?
What about the reception to President Ahmadinejad when he went to Iraq?
Well, of course, it was a very amazing contrast, remarkable contrast between the kind of furtive visits that President Bush has had to pay to bases way outside of Baghdad for just a couple of hours, and this triumphal procession from the Baghdad airport, where he arrives in broad daylight, and has press conferences and act like a visiting hero. And, of course, the government was very cordial to him. President Bush, just on the eve of the Ahmadinejad visit, had said in a sort of open fiat to al-Maliki, tell him to stop sending in weapons that are killing Americans. So in the presence of Ahmadinejad, with him at his side, al-Maliki said, when they were together in Baghdad, he praised Iran for helping to stabilize the security situation in Baghdad. And the next day, General Odierno in Washington again accused the Iranians of interfering. So we have an open breach now between the Bush administration and the Shia al-Maliki government over the issue of its relations with Iran. We also have the U.S. supporting a rival intelligence service opposed, working at cross purposes with the Ministry of National Security of Mr. al-Maliki, headed by a Sunni who used to work for Saddam Hussein. And so we have this Sunni, the U.S. directly involved now in the Sunni-Shia rivalry in Iraq.
Selig Harrison, director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy, once again covered Iran when he was a reporter for the Washington Post, a reporter currently for the Los Angeles Times in the Middle East. The Times Middle East correspondent is Borju Daragahi, who was in Baghdad when President Ahmadinejad visited there. And Borju, good to have you back on our program.
It's my pleasure.
You're now in Lebanon. I'm just interested in your take in what we have heard about the view from Tehran. What about the Iraqis at this point? And are they, in fact, encouraging Iranian involvement there, the Shiites at least? And what about this notion that perhaps the United States is trying to maintain a civil conflict between the Shiites and Sunnis in order to stay there?
I don't know. I mean, based on what the U.S. military and U.S. officials tell us and what their stated aims are, that is not their objective. Their objective is not to build up a Sunni militia to fight the Maliki government. Their objective is to get the Sunnis involved in the security game and hopefully at some point get the government of Maliki, Shiite-dominated government, to accept these guys as part of the security apparatus. If they don't, well, you know, that might be a very, very difficult situation. In that case, you might have a more intense version of the civil war-like conflict we saw in Iraq in 2006 and part of 2007. With regard to how the Iraqis view Iran, it's an extremely complicated situation. Listeners got to remember that not only do Iran and Iraq share a very, very long border, but most of Iraq's population centers are closer to Iran than any other country. So there's this organic connection in terms of trade, culture, and political influence that's been there for centuries, kind of cut off by Saddam Hussein and other Sunni Arab chauvinist leaders during the 20th century. But there's this natural gravitational pull that the two countries have on each other. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of people in Maliki's government, around Maliki, who are very suspicious about Iran and the game that Iran is playing in Iraq. Their understanding of it, they realize that Iran is in a situation where it's quite afraid of the U.S. and quite intimidated by the threats that the U.S. has made. And so it is sort of putting placeholders, putting chips on various players in Iraq in order to possibly use them against the U.S. in case of a military attack on its nuclear facilities. What the Iraqis are trying to do is trying to engage the Iranians, trying to assure them that they won't allow that to happen, and try to bring them into give them an interest in helping create a secure and prosperous Iraq.
In the context of the region as a whole, you have written, Borju Daragahi, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, that the U.S. and Iran are engaged in something that's really quite comparable to the Cold War in some respects. Tell us what you mean.
Well, Basically, for this is not anything groundbreaking, but they've been involved in sort of a 30-year Cold War. There's a proxy element to it, a military aspect to it. Just that the U.S. and the Soviet Union fought proxy wars in Asia and Latin America. There's a propaganda element to it. Iran has launched so many satellite channels over the past couple of years in English, Arabic, Pashto, trying to send its message to the broader Muslim world and to counter the U.S. message. So there's this propaganda element to it, and there's a sort of clandestine element to it. There's a cloak and dagger element to it, where the U.S. is trying to spy on the Iranians, and the Iranians are trying to spy on the U.S. And so in that sense, very clearly you have this sort of Cold War dimension to it. I think if you talk to some U.S. administration officials, I think they view this situation through the template of a Cold War, and they view it as a series of battlegrounds between Iran and the U.S. in Lebanon and Iraq and Afghanistan and the Persian Gulf, where they're competing not just for military supremacy, but the moral high ground as well.
Borju Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We're going to take a brief break, come back and talk a little bit more about the relationship of Iran to the rest of the Middle East. We'll do that after, just as I said, a brief break, and return in a moment with To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Alney talking again about Iran, its relationships with Iraq and with the United States, getting now to the broader issue of its relations with other countries in the Middle East. Ray Takei is a senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, the author of Hidden Iran, A Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
We heard earlier, and I think there seems to be a consensus, that the sanctions by the United Nations probably aren't going to be effective in getting Iran to stop its nuclear development. What does that have to do with its relations with its neighboring countries, the fact that it seems so confident that the sanctions aren't going to hurt it?
Well, the region, Iran's neighbors, has been gradually moving in a different direction. They may share some of the concerns and anxieties that the United States and the European countries have regarding Iran's escalating nuclear program and its emerging predominance in the Gulf. But the way they're choosing to deal with that is by being more inclusive and cooperative with Iran, bringing it into the framework of the Gulf Security Dialogue and so forth. So it's a sort of an opposite direction that the administration is taking. The United States is hoping to exclude and isolate and contain, while they're hoping to integrate and include.
What are they doing to integrate and include, given the fact that most of them are Sunnis, that they are Arabs, whereas the Iranians are, in fact, Persians?
Well, this is not so much a sort of a religious gathering, but a strategic cooperation, potentially. Perhaps Iran becoming a more significant player in the Gulf Cooperation Council, which historically evolved in the 1980s as an anti-Iranian Gulf alliance during the Iran-Iraq War. Bringing Iran into that particular framework in order to address some of the security concerns that the two sides have, and also perhaps establishing some ground rules about how the Persian Gulf security system is going to evolve in the aftermath of the Iraq War. The U.S.-Iraq War. You begin to see, for instance, the potential and indeed imminent normalization of relations between Iran and Egypt. I think we tend to be very accustomed in the United States to considering Iran's hostility to the United States. But among the regional countries that Iran has had much difficulty with since the inception of the revolution have been Saudi Arabia and Egypt. There have been no diplomatic relations with Egypt since 1979. They were severed because of Egypt's participation in the Camp David Accords and its normalization relations with Israel. That's beginning to change. So in essence, you began to see a greater degree of receptivity of the region toward a means of regulating Iranian power through some sort of inclusive strategic framework.
Are they willing? You said they might be concerned about nuclear development, but are they willing to see Iran get an atomic bomb?
I don't think anybody is hoping that Iran will achieve a nuclear weapon, because that obviously has the potential of destabilizing the region, if not the larger international system. The question at hand is, are there mechanism and means of ameliorating Iran's security concerns in order to prevent its crossing of that threshold? That remains to be seen.
Is the idea of isolating Iran in the region then at this point a lost cause, or are there things that could be done if, in fact, the United States wanted to continue that policy?
It's very difficult to see how Iran can be isolated in the Gulf particularly, but perhaps in the larger region as well. For one thing, the traditional barrier to Iranian power had always been Iraq. As I think Selja Harrison suggested, at the time when Iranian president is given a boisterous reception in Baghdad, and at the time when he had a pre-announced visit, something that no American official has managed to do for security concerns, it is hard to see that country being isolated in the Gulf. And in the larger Middle East, Iran does have alliances and allies. But the larger issue is, does the cause of ameliorating Iranian threat best serve through diplomacy or through practice of containment?
Ray Takye, again, at the Council on Foreign Relations. Borja Daragahi, back to you with the Los Angeles Times. I know you're in Beirut at the moment, but we have to remember that Iraq and Iran fought a long war. Is it surprising in that context that President Ahmadinejad was welcomed the way he was in Iraq? What's changed?
Well, I think that a lot of people, a lot of ordinary soldiers who fought in that war ultimately ended up blaming Saddam Hussein for it. But I think more fundamental, the people who are now in charge of Iraq, the Kurdish leaders and the Shiite leaders, were Iran's allies during that war. They fought alongside Jalal Talabani, who's the president of Iraq, fought alongside Iranian troops against Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war. Iran invested a lot of resources in cultivating various Iraqi groups. Those groups are all now in power.
So obviously there has been extraordinary change within Iraq. What about the ongoing dispute, though, between the Sunnis and the Shiites there? Ray Taki, back to you at the Council on Foreign Relations. You said this isn't a religious situation, but isn't religion terribly important in that part of the world? And isn't that enmity between those two Muslim divisions very important?
Oh, to be sure. The Shi community in Iraq has had a sort of a different approach and a different reception toward the Islamic Republic. And you kind of see that in its own narrative of the Iran-Iraq War. For the Sunnis in Iraq, Iran-Iraq War was the height of Sunni achievement, namely the barrier to Shi-Iranian expansionism. The Shi narrative, Iraqi Shi narrative, tends to be similar to the Iranian one, namely that they were all victims of Saddam. So in that sense, there is no realistic constituency within Iraq for sort of dealing with Iran. There's no question about the fact that the Sunni states and the Sunni populations are concerned about Iran's grandizement. But at this particular point, maybe just for a point, they're making the cold strategic calculation that the best way of dealing with this emerging and enlarging threat is through some sort of a diplomatic mediation. That, as I said, that may change if the prospects and of that diplomacy fail, if Iran continues to become more consolidate its influence in Iraq, and it develops a viable nuclear capability, they may alter their calculations. But at this particular point in time, this is, I suspect, where they are, and it is not where the administration is, which creates a difficult barrier, not between Iran and its neighbors, but between the United States and its Arab allies.
All right, Taki, I went against once again with the Council on Foreign Relations. Very quickly, we're almost out of time, but David Albright, back to you with the Institute for Science and International Security. You say that the U.S. at this point ought to be willing to engage in some kind of negotiations with Iran without preconditions. But once again, I think I asked you this before, but in the aftermath of what we've heard, it'd be interesting to hear your response again. Is there really any way that the United States can persuade Iran to give up its nuclear ambitions? Are they just simply going to go ahead?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, I think there are ways the U.S., because finally, it's what Iran's doing is extremely on economic activity. It can afford it now, obviously, with oil prices as high as they are. It is going to suffer some isolation. It's having to reorient its economy to look to more toward China than Europe, which is going to have some consequences on their economy in the long run. There's certainly, you know, a package of incentives that can still be offered to Iran. And more importantly, if the United States truly engages with, or I should say negotiates with Iran, without this constant threat of regime change or military threats, also what Ray mentioned, trying to reduce the security incentives in the region for Iran to seek nuclear weapons, I think we can keep Iran from going nuclear. I would argue, though, that the sanctions are an important part of it because you want to inflict some pain on the regime so that it understands that there is, in a sense, a tax being placed on its economy, and can help them think through how to get it off. And that's worked in the past with countries, Libya,
okay.
Also with apartheid South Africa.
All right. Obviously a challenge that will face the next president and the current one as well. We'll see what happens before the election and afterwards. David Albright with the Institute for Science and International Security. Ray Taki at the Council on Foreign Relations. Borju Daragahi with the LA Times. And Selig Harrison at the Center for International Policy. Many thanks to all of you for being with us. Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Dan Konecki and Gary Scott. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast by KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.